Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with #WhyPublicRadio.
Investigators in New York are learning more about that fire at a five-story apartment building in the Bronx that killed at least a dozen people, including four children. Earlier today, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio told WNYC's Brian Lehrer that the fire was started by a child playing with a stove on the building's first floor.
I know there were concerns raised about the building itself. Based on the research we have at this moment, it does not appear that there was anything problematic about the building or the fire safety in the building. It seems like a horrible, tragic accident.
And one of the deadliest fires, or the deadliest fire, I should say, in New York City in more than 25 years. Joining us now with more is Stephen Nesson, a reporter with WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Well, first of all, so we heard that tape from Mayor de Blasio about the cause of the fire. He says it's an accident. What else do we know about what happened?
Well, the fire department determined it was actually started by a 3-year-old that was playing with the burners on the stove. The fire commissioner said that the mother wasn't aware that anything was going on until the child started screaming. And then that's when she saw there was smoke and fire, and she grabbed her 2- and 3-year-old and left. The problem here was she left with her door wide open. The fire commissioner says the stairway was like a chimney. The fire just swept up the stairs so fast that many people couldn't escape. At least 5 people died in their homes. Other people got out through the fire escape, but that created another problem with more oxygen feeding the fire, which just made everything worse.
Yeah. Now, listeners may have heard a little voice there with you, and let's just fully acknowledge you're a working dad, and these are the holidays here, so I understand that there's a little person in the studio there with you, which is quite all right. We understand. But, I mean, speaking of little people, at least 4 children died in this fire. What else do we know about the victims?
Like I said, several of them died in their homes. 5 people died in the homes. Others were taken to hospital where they later died. Basically, the fire commissioner is saying children should not be left unattended with fire near a stove. That was the biggest problem, and they said this happens all the time. It's actually pretty common. The ages of the children that died range from 1 to 7 years old. There's still identifying the exact names of the victims. They haven't been released yet. But the fire commissioner also added there was nothing particularly problematic about the building. It was just the behavior. Leaving a door open during a fire is the worst thing you can do. And of course, people had to escape through the windows, which is entirely normal, but it didn't help the situation.
Yeah. Have we heard from witnesses?
We've heard from our reporters here at WNYC have spoken with people who live near the building, and they describe just pandemonium, people running out. It was a crazy scene last night. We actually heard that there's a transitional shelter across the street from the home, and they were offering clothes to people who lived in the building.
Hmm. Now, you know, I heard, again, that Mayor de Blasio says the building itself wasn't necessarily a problem, but there were concerns raised about it. I mean, what are the biggest questions going forward?
Well, I did some research on the city's records website, and the building is part of, it's called Housing Preservation and Development, meaning it does get some support from the city. It's not clear in what way. It may be just affordable housing units, but they're still looking into it. And according to the records, there was a defective smoke and carbon monoxide detector found in August on the first floor. It's not clear if it's the same apartment where the fire was started. But according to the records, that violation should have been resolved by October. But what's not clear is whether it was resolved, whether a fine was paid, or whether a smoke detector was replaced. And the mayor and his officials are still looking into exactly what the situation with that is.
Stephen Nesson, he's a reporter with WNYC in New York, updating us on the investigation into that deadly fire at an apartment building in the Bronx.
President Trump says the Russia inquiry makes the U.S. look bad and puts the country in a bad position. But he also tells the New York Times in an interview published today that he believes special counsel Robert Mueller will treat him fairly. The Times also reports that Trump insisted 16 times that the inquiry has turned up no collusion with Russia so far. The Russia probe has been a major issue during the president's first year in office, and it's one of the challenges he'll face again in 2018. There are many other pressing issues, too. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Welcome back, Julian, and Happy New Year a little bit early.
Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
So as we look ahead to the new year, how do you place in the context of history the first year of the Trump presidency?
Well, it's certainly been one of the most turbulent that we've seen. It's been unconventional. We've seen many traditions and many norms uprooted, and we've seen many institutions come under threat. He's achieved more, I think, than some of his critics acknowledge, including on deregulation and, of course, on the tax cut that passed at the end of the year.
And is that fact that he has delivered the reason or reason enough to keep some of members of his own party who might be uncomfortable, but to keep them basically satisfied enough?
Well, there's a tension. On the one hand, I do think that placates them and leaves some Republicans on Capitol Hill to say, whatever he's doing, we will support him as long as he can deliver these kinds of measures, particularly on the economy. But on the other hand, the polls are real, and he is historically at lows in terms of his approval ratings, and poll after poll is showing that the midterms can be a wave election. And that is not something that sits well with Republicans. So they have to balance these two things as the year progresses. And I think that will be one of the big stories of 2018.
Well, the election's, of course, coming up next year. How tough will it be for Democrats to regain control of Congress? Because it seems as if there are already many lawmakers and many candidates are already in campaign mode.
It will be tough, but I think the situation is looking good for Democrats, certainly as a result of all kinds of odd stories and unexpected developments. The Senate is now up for play, and because of President Trump's turbulent record and very unpopular decisions nationally, the House is also a race where Democrats can win. So if Democrats play this the right way, we could certainly be looking at a Democratic Congress come January 2019.
If that did happen, how tough would it be for Capitol Hill and the White House to get anything done? I mean, if Democrats do regain control of Congress, would that be a game changer for the Trump presidency?
Sure would. I mean, it's not as if he's been very successful with the Republicans. Most of what he's done through executive action. But things would certainly get a lot tougher. Democrats would be in no mood to make deals with this president, and they'll be thinking about 2020, and they'll be thinking about the fundamental differences between what Democrats stand for and between what this administration has represented to the world. And at the same time, they will also be more willing to move forward with investigations and looking into many different kinds of problems that have been made clear with how this administration conducts its business.
Julian, I wonder how you view the Me Too movement of this past year and even the Black Lives movement, Black Lives Matter movement before that. Do you see the traction that they have gained continuing to the extent that there could be more done by decision makers? The kind of momentum will move in that direction. Or do you see these things dying a slow death?
Well, I don't think they'll die a slow death, but there is a question, can they now translate the huge changes they've made in the national conversation and in changing how Americans think of problems from institutional racism to sexual harassment? Can they translate that into changes in electoral politics? Can they get more candidates to vow their support to concrete policy changes?
Let me just interrupt you there. I mean, do you think they can? Do they have that kind of
I think they power? Can. I think they can. I think they have changed the national conversation in a way that suggests there could be electoral pressure from voters to actually do something about the many problems that have been exposed. So they have the potential, but potential in politics doesn't translate into success. And there's been many movements that have not been able to make that shift. So I think it's going to be very important. And policy changes are needed as well. So far, a lot of this is focused on individual wrongdoing. wrongdoers, from police to Hollywood executives on both fronts. But there need to be policy changes in the corporate world as well as in the public sector to make sure that all of these problems are actually addressed. But it will be a tough, tough fight in the next 2 years to make sure that they don't fade.
Bigger picture before we let you go, Julian, has the Trump presidency changed your thinking at all as a historian in terms of how we should look at the role of the American president going forward?
Absolutely. I think the president, any historian would have to admit, has just broken many conventions where there is this expectation that there will be outrage about some of the behavior that we've seen, about some of the positions that he's taken that are very extreme. And there is outrage, but nothing's really happened. He moves forward. And I think historians will have to rethink some assumptions about what's possible in terms of violating those norms and stressing the institutions of our democracy.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's the end of 2017, and the opioid epidemic in America continues to grow. The Centers for Disease Control is reporting that nearly 64,000 people died from taking an overdose of the drugs last year, and the numbers keep rising for all age groups. The opioid crisis is hitting one part of the country especially hard, the Northeast. One of the cities that's been ravaged by the abuse of heroin, fentanyl, and prescription drugs is New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's a working-class city and a huge fishing port. Police there have responded to more than 500 opioid overdoses this year alone. 40 of those overdoses were lethal. The toll the epidemic has taken on cities such as New Bedford is overwhelming. But this year, police report that the number of overdoses has finally gone down, at least a bit. So has the number of deaths. Police think part of the credit for the drop goes to a band of civic leaders who are trying to get a grip on the crisis. They're reaching out to those who've overdosed, one individual at a time. They make it personal. They go to their homes.
We have two additional addresses that were given to us, which would be new addresses, first visits.
The team always includes a police officer, some kind of drug counselor, and a member of the clergy. They knock on the door unannounced. On one rainy afternoon, they let us come along.
Next will be County Street. Fallen County, we'll go to Conduit.
The group gathers outside New Bedford Police Headquarters and charts its course for the next several hours. The officer leading the team today is Lieutenant Arthur Hegarty. He's not in uniform, just khakis, a casual shirt, and a fleece vest. He holds a clipboard with names and addresses of seven people the team will try to visit over the next few hours. Most of the information comes from 911 calls to report an overdose. The goal isn't to arrest anyone. They want to talk, to engage, and to steer the person away from a fatal overdose.
It's all about trying to connect with them, build that relationship, build a trust.
Reverend David Lima heads the Interchurch Council of Greater New Bedford. He and the police started reaching out to people who were addicted more than 2 years ago.
The best outcome, the ultimate, would be to get them into treatment beds, being able to get them to a place where they'd be able to get the help they need long term.
So the hope is high. The expectation is modest. The team members head out in an unmarked police car. They say they don't want to raise fears or shame for people struggling with addiction. The first stop is at the home of a man whose family asked the outreach workers to come by. They knock on the door. We wait behind with Reverend Lima. Lima says the initial challenge is just to be invited inside.
Once you get in the house, the team really works well in being able to help people understand that it's about caring.
Many communities in the country have opioid outreach programs, but this one includes a member of the clergy on every ride. This time, there are two, including Reverend Lima. They say they don't proselytize, but they look for chances to connect with someone through faith. Lima says if he sees a Bible in someone's home, he might ask if the person abusing drugs is part of a church.
You find many times that they may have been, but because their use is up, the shame and stigma, the guilt of being before God while I'm in sin, they have separated themselves. We try to help connect them again.
By doing what?
By telling them, look, did these people care for you when you were there? Well, yeah, they were always worried about me. I says, well, I'm betting they still do.
As we talk, the team members are invited into the first house. They come out after about 15 minutes. The counselor on tonight's team is Connie Mimoso from a local behavior health center.
Basically, we engage with a family member. The party we were looking for stayed away from us.
But he or she was there?
Mm-hmm. Downstairs in the basement. And she disclosed that he has heavy mental illnesses and that he's living in the basement. He only comes up now to eat. That's it. So a lot of times we have to engage with the family in order to begin to break some of that, those barriers.
So by that standard, this was a successful visit. At the second stop, the woman they want to speak with is sleeping. Her boyfriend says she's doing well and getting help. The team has no way to know whether that's true. The next stop is different. They're tracking down a woman they've talked to before.
Middle-aged female indicated that she was open to a follow-up checkup.
Lieutenant Hegarty stops the car across the street from a multifamily house in a middle-class neighborhood. A slender woman in jeans is out on the sidewalk. She spots the unmarked car and makes a beeline toward the sliding glass door to her apartment, but it's locked. She later told us she darted away because she thought she was going to get arrested. So she turns around and instantly recognizes one member of the outreach team. It's 44-year-old Pastor Jamie Casey. He's been here before. He calls her by name to kneel, and they start to talk. After a couple of minutes, the pastor turns to us.
Tennille was just telling us that she's actually ready for detox. So she's ready.
Mm-hmm. Those words are like gold. Someone's deciding to get clean. The outreach team doesn't waste a second.
Or do you need somebody to come and pick you up?
I would need transportation.
Okay, so if I have someone here for 9 a.m., you'll be ready to go at 9 a.m.
Tennille Pina is 40 years old, a mother of four, but her children don't live with her. Her brother does live there, but she wants him out because he's addicted, too. Just then, the skies open up. We all huddle under umbrellas, and she tells us her story.
How long have you been using?
15 years.
How come you're ready now?
I don't know how to explain it. It's harder. Like they say, the runs get shorter. And it's harder to find dope around here these days, too. A lot of fentanyl going around.
Have you tried to get free before?
Absolutely.
How many times?
A lot of times.
It's wretched to go through withdrawal. By the way, when she says the runs are shorter, she means her heroin highs don't last as long as they used to. And then there's the fentanyl, a more powerful opioid that's often mixed with heroin these days. That mix causes most of the overdoses.
I've said it a bunch of times, I just want to shake it. I want to shake it. It's a very hard habit to shake. My kid's father told me when I first started messing with it, he said, you're in for a ride till the wheels fall off.
As we leave, Tennille Pina asks if anybody on the team is recovering from addiction. Pastor Jamie Casey answers yes. He's 8 years clean.
You made my day.
And the two have another connection. Casey tells us as we walk to the car that when he was talking to Tennille Pina, she mentioned her faith to him.
She said, I believe in God. I believe God is good. And I said, I believe he just showed up and proved that to you, you know.
These anti-opioid teams head out three nights a week. They've made close to 600 home visits in all. They say nobody's expressed privacy concerns over the team showing up unannounced, even though a few family members weren't aware there even had been an overdose until the team showed up at the door. At one of the apartments the group visits that night, there's a young man who recently overdosed at his father's gravesite. His licensed gun was in the car. The team's been concerned that he might use the weapon, that he could be suicidal. The man answers the front door, tells them he's all set, and doesn't want any help. At one of the final stops for the night, there is a far different interaction. A woman named Lucinda Pereira opens the door.
I have two sons.
Two of her sons are addicted to heroin. One has overdosed repeatedly. The pastor, Jamie Casey, takes the lead in the conversation.
Does he want to get well? When you talk to him, does he say he wants treatment? Does he want to get away from the drugs?
Yes, he do.
Yeah.
Cuando él no tiene dinero.
That son lives with her in a triple-decker. She doesn't know where he is right now.
Give him our cards. Tell him we're back again. We're going to keep coming back until we see him.
Okay. I mean, he might come home maybe around 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know. Sometimes I want to leave him out, but sometimes I say, God, so I leave him out. How about something happened to him or he done something bad?
Yeah.
So I open the door, he comes in, he eats, he takes a shower, he sleeps.
You know, there's some things that you can do too for yourself, because this is a lot on you. So
it is a lot.
If you call Connie over at Seven Hills, they can give you some support services.
Pereira invites everybody into her home. Inside, there are family photos on about every wall. It turns out that Pereira doesn't have a supply of the drug Narcan. That's the nasal spray that can reverse an overdose. Drug counselor Connie Mimoso shows her how to administer it. She leaves two doses behind. Lucinda Pereira says she'll do anything to get her kids off opioids.
I think I'll be the happiest mother in the world. Goes for me and goes for all the mother who suffer, because a lot of mothers are suffering with this.
Yeah,
you're right. Know? You're right. I don't just pray for me, I pray for the people, because a lot of people is deal with these things just like I am, you know? No matter how good you raise your children.
We've got this postscript to our story. The conversation with that woman, Lucinda Pereira, paid off. Her son contacted Pastor Jamie Casey and went into detox. It's not clear right now, though, if he's still in recovery, but Casey is hopeful. And as for Tennille Pina, the woman we talked with in the rain, the day after our visit, she was so eager to get clean, she didn't even wait for a car to pick her up. She walked to Pastor Casey's office that morning, and he helped her get into detox. Since then, she's had inpatient treatment, too. It has not been an easy road for Pina, but she hasn't given up. One sign of hope in New Bedford, the number of opioid overdoses has declined 23% this year as of last month. On our website, hereandnow.org, you'll find photos of the outreach team at work, and the young pastor Jamie Casey, the one who created a bond with Tennille, shares his own story of his 20-year struggle with addiction and how he got his life back.
George Weah, a former international soccer star turned senator, has won the presidential election runoff in Liberia. He defeated the current vice president, who conceded today. Liberia is now poised for a peaceful democratic transition of power for the first time in decades. NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton joins us now from Dakar, Senegal, where she's monitoring developments in Liberia. And Ophabia, first of all, tell us about George Weah. Who is he?
We're talking about a rags-to-riches story here. George Weah was brought up poor in the shanty towns outside the capital, Monrovia, where, as many young Liberians boy do, he was kicking about a soccer ball, and he went on to be an international striker, and he's the only African who has ever been chosen by FIFA as the global soccer player of the year. So George Weah is huge, not just in Liberia, but in other parts of Africa too. He's seen as somebody who has managed on his own two feet to succeed.
Huh. Now, this is the second time he's run for president in Liberia. He's also run once for vice president. What led to his success in this election?
I think it's time for change in Liberia. George Weah is not seen as part of the elite, and people see him as being different, not being tainted with corruption. They see him as being honest, modest, and somebody who will deliver on his promises.
This is such a fascinating election because Weah's vice presidential running mate is Jewel Howard Taylor, an ex-wife of the former rebel leader turned president Charles Taylor. Now, of course, Charles Taylor is serving a prison sentence for war crimes. So what does that association mean for Weah?
It is actually really important because Charles Taylor, as you said, is a convicted war criminal. But when he was the leader of Liberia, he was hugely influential within the country and in West Africa. And there are real, genuine fears that Taylor might be, in some ways, the puppet master from his prison cell. George Weah has said, "Look, I am my own man. It will not be Charles Taylor who is twiddling the buttons here." But a lot of people feel that that is something that he and Liberia are going to have to look out for.
Well, then, Ophabia, why did he have Jewel Howard Taylor as his running mate to begin with?
She's experienced. She's also a senator. As a ticket, they were hugely popular, especially amongst Liberia's young, dispossessed, especially young men. Unemployment is high, the economy is stumbling, and these young people want George Weah to deliver on his pledges of jobs, prosperity, and a Liberia that works without corruption, without the elites seen to be A, in charge, and B, profiting.
Final question, Ophabia. If I have this right, this may be one of the first peaceful transitions of power, democratic transitions of power in Liberia since, what, the 1940s? So what is the mood there right now in the country?
Elation. You should have heard George Weah's supporters. They were chanting his name, George Weah, George Weah, singing, dancing. They do see this as a turning point for Liberia.
Well, that's NPR Africa correspondent Ophabia Quist-Arkton speaking to us from Dakar. Ophabia, thank you so very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
As the year draws to a close, we'd like to take a look at the world of food, specifically what's been trending this year and what we can expect to be hot, literally and figuratively, in 2018. Here to help us do that is Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guntz. Nice to see you as always, Kathy.
Hi, Lisa.
One of the things that you want to highlight, I know, are spices and spice blends. Now, given the fact that spices have been around for millennia, what are you seeing now that's different?
Suddenly, we're seeing really interesting new spices and spice blends. I talked to Lior Lev Sirkarts from La Boite, a spice company in New York City, and I asked him, if you had to pinpoint one spice that encapsulates 2017, what would it be? And he said, well, it's certainly been a year of global ethnic influences. The Middle East and Israel have been on everyone's radar. He was born on a kibbutz in northern Israel. So he is very familiar with two spices I have there. One is called baharat. It's a blend of allspice, cinnamon, and cloves, and it works incredibly well with savory foods like chicken and vegetables. So I took a butternut squash, and I roasted it, and I sprinkled it with baharat. And I guess the thing about spices and spice blends, and the reason I see them becoming very big in 2018, is that it's a single ingredient that can greatly alter your everyday cooking.
Easily.
Exactly. That's the point. If you bought one new spice or spice blend and used it in your everyday food, the same things you rely on, they're going to taste different. When you taste that butternut squash with the baharat, it suddenly is smoky and savory and a little bit sweet and evocative of a culture very far from my main kitchen.
But if it's a very different spice, and I think that's what you're getting at, because I know spices have been really kind of de rigueur for a while now, but you're really trying, like going deep into certain countries or regions and drawing out spices that might be new on the shelves in various spice shops. How do you know how to use it, though? I mean, if you want to use it more than once and not just have it wasting away on the shelf.
That's where experimenting comes in. I mean, no one told me to put it on butternut squash, but I thought squash is often slightly sweet. When you roast it, it kind of caramelizes. I thought this spice blend would work well with it. I would like to roast a chicken with this next. I would like to sprinkle it onto a winter green salad. You also have on the plate a spice blend that many people have now heard of called za'atar. It's sumac, wild oregano, and sesame seeds. Some people also add thyme to it. Incredible sprinkled on fish and grilled, or on meats, on steak, or your roast beef, or your salads. I think the truth is that these spices are not going to ruin any food. They're simply going to give it a depth of flavor that might not have been there before. And so I think more and more cooks are going to become interested in using these. And as I said, the key word here is experimenting.
There's something else that I'd like to ask you about. This is a product that has become increasingly popular, especially this year. And this is artisanal vinegars. First off, that term is used, maybe overused, but what does artisanal mean?
It means that it's vinegar that's made in small batches. It's often aged. In Italy, for those who have tasted balsamic vinegar, that's a long tradition of aging vinegar in wooden casks. Here in the United States, you're starting to see small batch vinegars. I have one in front of me from Carr's Cider House. This is cider vinegar. It's been aged. It smells of apples. It smells of autumn. And it smells of being distilled. It is a beautiful vinegar to use in sauces and salads. And what I did was I made for you a kind of braised chicken dish. In Lyon, France, chicken with vinegar is a traditional dish. This is my Americanized version. I took chicken pieces and browned them, and then I added half a cup of this really good cider vinegar, sauteed a red onion, lots of garlic cloves, and let it cook for about a half an hour until it became very tender. And surprisingly, the vinegar is subtle. You might think,
that is
wait,
surprising, because vinegar's not subtle.
No, it's not. But these artisanal ciders, vinegars, and different types of wine vinegars have a subtlety that you won't find in a regular supermarket vinegar.
Really? Huh.
And if you watch cooking shows, you will hear always chefs saying, it's good, but it needs acid. Acidity is a key element in really good food, and it's one that many American cooks, home cooks, overlook. So I think this might be the year we see more of this. There are several new books dedicated to the subject. Acid Trip, great title, Travels in the World of Vinegar by Michael Harlan Turkle is all about vinegar made around the world, how to make your own, and how to cook with it. I think you're going to be seeing vinegar on a lot of menus highlighted as a key ingredient, and I think we're going to start to understand the role acidity plays in cooking, the way that it makes flavors pop. A little bit of a good vinegar can make an ordinary dish tastes really exceptional.
And I think it's kind of rediscovering this because you mentioned France, but I think my Italian ancestors also made vinegar chicken and used vinegar a lot.
It's all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to make a bit of a turn here and talk a little bit about something that's been going on in terms of the news and in popular culture, in government echelons, in the media, and that is allegations of bad behavior on the part of many people in the top ranks of their field, including the popular, very popular TV chef Mario Batali.
Anyone that's ever worked in a restaurant kitchen knows that the bro culture, and by that I mean the guys, which are prominently what you find in top-end restaurants, the bro culture is in trouble. Certainly we've heard about Mario Batali. We're hearing more and more, and I am going to predict that in 2018 we are going to continue to hear about famous chefs, top chefs, who are not respectful and are running kitchens where there's all kinds of nasty stuff going on.
You're talking about men mostly?
I'm talking about men exclusively. And then what I think might happen, what I am hoping happens as this becomes exposed, is that 2018 will indeed be the year of the woman chef. I think it's going to get easier for women to get financial backing to open their own restaurants.
Because of this, you mean as an offshoot?
Very much so. This bro culture is so invasive. It is so much in trouble. I am very interested in 2018 in supporting restaurants that are run by women.
Is it hard for women to get funding? Is it hard for women to achieve the top rung in the restaurant?
Let me answer by asking you a question. How many of your favorite restaurants are run by women?
Mm-hmm. That sometimes you don't even know.
You don't know, but there's a reason for that. There are many really talented women chefs running kitchens across the country. But the big ones you hear about are the men over and over again. And they are the ones that have been abusing this power, and we're learning more about it. It's a sad moment everywhere.
You know, one of the other things just tied to the news again that it's interesting to remember is that when a country is at war, it's making news headlines a lot. Very often, for people outside the country, that's how we hear about a given country's cuisine. I think it happened with Afghanistan, which is happening now with Syria. And I
Absolutely.
Know, even though we should say people are starving in Syria, you think that Syrian cuisine, we're going to be hearing a lot more about it next year.
If you Google the best Syrian food in restaurants in the United States, you'll see pop-up restaurants in New Jersey, New York City, Brooklyn, Anaheim, California, Orange County, California, Virginia. This did not exist several years ago. So one of the ways that we react to the news is by trying to find out about the culinary traditions. And immigrants are here, and often the only thing that they've brought are their recipes. When you leave a country quickly because your life is in danger, you don't take much with you, but you do always bring your culinary traditions. It's not an immigrant culture, but I think we'll be hearing a lot more about Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican cuisine after the catastrophe there.
All right. Thank you. One more question, Kathy Gunst. As we talk about food trends, I wonder if you can tell us if you see any other trend for 2018.
We've heard a lot about box food trends, you know, Blue Apron and all these different companies.
Home delivery services.
Yes. Home delivery services are very hot. I have been talking to a lot of people who have said to me, you know, we did the box foods for a year, and what happened was we learned to cook. We started doing the same dishes over and over again, and then we canceled the box foods and we started cooking. So on the optimistic note I would like to end with, I think 2018 will see more people cooking on their own without the assistance of a box arriving in the mail.
Will you still cook for us, please?
I promise.
Thank you. Kathy Gunst will have her recipes for the squash and the vinegar chicken at hereandnow.org. Happy New Year, Kathy. Thank you.
Happy New Year. Thank you, Lisa.
According to the Pentagon, 33 U.S. troops were killed in war zones in 2017. 21 died in combat. Vera Bergen-Gruen covers the Pentagon for BuzzFeed News, and we have a link to her piece about U.S. military deaths in 2017. That's at hereandnow.org. She joins us from WLRN in Miami. Vera, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, can you put the deaths of these 33 U.S. troops into context for us? Because, I mean, on the one hand, the numbers aren't anything like they were at the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Correct. You know, people read this piece and I got a lot of feedback about how it didn't seem to really merit this kind of piece. But the thing is, of course, at the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2007, we all remember, you know, that year, for example, the combined total was around over 1,000 troops who died abroad. And of course, at the same time, the troop total in Iraq and Afghanistan was 200,000, whereas now it's much, much lower. So it is, while it is obviously a proportionally lower number, at the same time, what we discovered by putting this together was that the troops who died in combat zones for the first time in 6 years, that number has risen. Like we said, this year was 33. The last year was 26. So in context, you know, of course, has gone down proportionally. So, but it's less about the number and also more about the places where they died. They keep dying in Afghanistan as they have for the last 17 years. But this time there was just as many troops dying, for example, in Africa as fighting against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So that's a pretty interesting development.
Right. So that's actually kind of where I wanted to go next here, because, you know, nevertheless, we also are still talking about 33 troops who have died, 33 new Gold Star families. But to the point that you were making earlier, many of these soldiers died in places that maybe most Americans didn't even know there was a U.S. military presence, right? Yemen, Niger, Somalia. Can you talk about that in the context of the decisions that are being made in the Trump administration?
So President Trump has given the military a lot more authority to make these decisions. He has delegated a lot of that authority so that the military commanders can make these decisions on their own without having to pass through Washington when it comes to putting certain special forces on the ground or carrying out certain counterterrorism operations. And he has also loosened a lot of these restrictions that existed under the Obama administration, which many generals criticized as micromanaging things that they didn't understand. So what that basically translates to is in many parts of Yemen, in many parts of Somalia, they now have this freedom to put U.S. troops on the ground and carry out these kind of operations we saw with the raid in Yemen in January, where a Navy SEAL died, this patrol in Niger that went wrong. And so all these different operations now are happening in a lot of countries where before you just couldn't do it. So a lot of this is directly related to the Trump administration's loosening of these authorities and also giving the military a lot more power, basically, to do this on their own.
Mm. So you also write about a couple of trends that we've seen over the course of this past year. To be honest, some of them are quite disturbing. I mean, first, you talk about the trend towards less transparency from the Pentagon on how and where U.S. troops are killed. What have you seen there?
A lot of this lack of transparency is directly related to the increasing reliance on special forces. So what that means is that a lot of these special operations forces, and we're talking about Green Berets and Navy SEALs and these highly trained, specialized groups, They are often operating in a lot of secrecy on classified missions. And so when things go wrong, as happened in Yemen, which was a raid on a compound that turned into this really intense firefight, or in Niger, which was supposedly a patrol, but we know that they were doing something else, and then they were ambushed. In these kind of situations, we still don't really know what happened to them. The military doesn't really have to tell the public because they can say that it's a classified mission. So this lack of transparency is directly related to this over-reliance on special forces to carry these out. And it's also directly related to them telling us a lot less about the numbers of troops in a lot of these places. For example, for most of this year, we in the Pentagon press corps were told that there were 503 troops on the ground in Syria. And we were told this over and over again, even though privately we were told there were thousands. And finally, last month, they told us, yes, actually, that number is closer to 2,000 troops on the ground in Syria. There's been a difference between Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and the president. The president, as he said when he announced his Afghanistan strategy, for example, is a big fan of saying that they want to take the enemy by surprise. We're not going to tell the public what kind of numbers of troops are on the ground and where they are, because that it's part of our military strategy. Whereas Mattis has said that he wants to be a lot more transparent, and he has put out a lot of these numbers, whereas the White House is trying not to. So there's this interesting kind of tension between how they're approaching transparency when it comes to troop levels.
Well, Vera Bergen-Gruen covers the Pentagon for BuzzFeed News. Vera, thank you so very much. This was absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Robin Young is back on Monday as we start the new year. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.